All right, good morning, everyone. I trust you can all hear me back there. I'm very excited to get to talk to you about this stuff this morning. I've been working... We're good again? We'll have some whiteouts, you know, and keep you guys awake. Right, so I've been working on this for about a year, on and off as time allowed, and now you guys get to see it. What you're seeing is not complete. You can't download this and run it, but what we're going to cover are sort of the most interesting bits that make it compelling, I think. So these are the things we'll be talking about in the next half hour-ish. Why I'm working on it and sort of the overall big picture of the architecture of the system. The two things we're really going to get into are the Butterfest disk format, because you need to understand that to understand the CRFS wire format. Then we'll have some performance results, the ones that are good, and sort of an overview of the coherency protocol, because you'd think for the coherent remote file system, coherency would be important. It's not implemented yet. But I have some good stories. And then we'll be done. And so if at any point you find yourselves not quite grasping a slide, please let me know and we can dig in, because small number of slides, largest amount of knowledge per slide, I think. I haven't a clue. I'm thinking surfs, crifs, I don't know. Butterfs, that's critical. Right. We started with Btree and Better, but butter is delicious, so. All right, so we'll really jump in. Motivation number one for me is performance. This graph is demonstrating how far NFS is from what the hardware is capable of. The graph on the top, green lines are disk throughput as measured by block trace. Blue lines are network throughput as measured by TCP dump on the server. The first slide is us sending an uncompressed Linux source tree tarball through Netcat, so it's a streaming TCP socket, to the server, who then expands it on the server into ext3. So of course this is disk bound, because ext3 is doing what it does. But at least you get pretty good, right? I mean, 35, 40 megasecond, it's a single SATA drive. Down at the bottom, we have doing an async NFS3 TCP mount and doing the tarball extraction on the client. And here we're network latency bound. We putz along at 5 megasecond or something. The green lines are plateaus like that because this is an async server mount. You can see in the lower left of the bottom graph, the time from when the blue starts to the time from when the green start is when your data would have been lost if the server crashed. But if we made this a sync mount and that the server actually wrote it to disk every time it was asked to, this takes 500 seconds or something. It's ridiculous. So to make it even comparable, it's an async mount. So it's 5 times the time. And there, when you think about it, it's about the same data that should be communicated. Yes, sir?
Sorry, you made an async export?
I do. Have I been saying? Yeah, not a sync mount, sorry. It is, yeah, an async export.
Can you repeat that?
I made it sound like it was a sync mount and that all the operations on the client on the mount would be synchronous. It's an async export and that all the writes on the server are in memory and then get flushed to disk later. Terminology is not careful. So we have some low-hanging fruit on the performance side. And it's the order of magnitude of the performance, potential performance improvement, times 5, that is significant, because that in that amount of performance improvement, you can change behavior, right? This won't just be a 10% workload. This will be, I can now do something over the network file system that I couldn't before because it was unbearable. Motivation number two, it's not, when you go to deploy an application on NFS, you have to make sure you're not doing something that is different. This is sort of unfair because I'm picking on the most egregious one that NFS does. And let's start this off by saying NFS is fantastic. We're all here and care about network file systems because NFS is so successful. In this case, this is demonstrating that if you hold an open file descriptor on a file and you unlink it, there's still a directory entry there for that file in the directory. So in the first case, you do the unlink and then you remove the directory and you can remove the directory. There's no more entries. In the NFS case, when it did that unlink of the file, it didn't actually unlink the file. It unlinked that name and created another name to the file so that the NFS server could get at it later. So that makes our poor little guy very sad because he wrote his app and he tested it and it worked, and then two or three people removed from him, they tried it on NFS and it broke and he got a bug report and it took him 6 months to find this. So this is the other motivation for me. We need to do our users a favor and have network file systems behave like the file systems they develop on their workstations. Those are the big ones. So we can talk about the overview here. These are the moving pieces, and we should spend some time on this because there's a lot buried in here. We'll start with the drives and work our way back to the client. So we have our data in a file system on disk. It's in a ButterFS file system. We have a user space server, CRFSD, which is working directly with the ButterFS disk structures. It's reading and writing blocks. You don't export a mounted file system. You don't share that mounted file system with anybody else. CRFSD owns that data and works with it. These overlay bubbles above the blocks are the state it keeps while it's running. The ButterFS block cache is obvious, right? Instead of reading and writing to disk, sometimes it holds some cached in memory. The global cache stat table, state table, is an awkward phrase for me pressing the wrong button. For the aggregate coherency state of all the clients in the network, this will make more sense when we get to what the client's holding, but the server at any given time can tell you what state all the data is in across the network.
So just to make sure I understand, if on the server you need to, for administrative purpose, for example, access this ButterFS file system, you have to mount it locally.
Yeah, the question is, to access data in a ButterFS file system that's being served by CRFS, do you have to do a local mount of the CRFS file system? Yes. And we may do some implementation tricks, fast paths with pages and stuff to make that bearable, and I think we can. But yes, you have to go through CRFSD if you want to get at that data. So yes, we're CRFSD, we're doing blocks on disk, we're holding some stuff in memory. Across the wire, it's a TCP socket to each client. All we really care about trading are item ranges, and that'll make sense in the coming slides. Everything in ButterFS are items, key value pairs. Only those items cross the wire to the client. All the other ButterFS metadata, the B-trees, the journaling, all that stuff, the clients never see. The clients just see the raw data itself. So the clients and the server trade this data as it's running, and they do cache state transactions, transitions. The client can ask for something to be held in a cache state. The server can tell it to revoke a state it had, and we'll get to that too. In the client, it's currently a Linux kernel module. Because we're cache coherent, we have to get it the hooks in the kernel for maintaining cache state. The client holds in memory cached CRFS items, so we get both, you know, read cache of data we had read previously, and absolutely most importantly, we get write back caching of both metadata and data. We don't have to go to the server to perform writes. And the other thing it holds in memory is its perspective of that state table. So the things, the data it has in memory has a state, exclusive, shared, invalid. It has to record what it is, and that's its slice. The server's view is the aggregate of all the clients. So we're very stateful, we're TCP. There's only one server, 111, not parallel, not distributed. We can do some failover stuff, and maybe we can talk about that, but I don't have slides, so you'll have to ask if you want to hear about it. So lots of Linux kernel clients, TCP sockets to one server in user space talking to ButterFS blocks on disk. That's the highest level overview. Everyone has that framed in their head. We can now talk about the formats that cross the wire. So I think that's next. And it's not. I lied. Usually I have a nice little preview window thing, but there was some technology, and now I only get what you guys see, and it's very disappointing. So back here, we're doing ButterFS direct to the file system, right? We don't get to export an XFS file system, despite that we'd want to. And so we have to justify that, right? That's a burden for users. They have to get their data into ButterFS to be able to serve it with CRFS. So why do we go to that trouble? Because we get a bunch of really cool stuff that you don't get in POSIX. The first one, I tried as many buzzwords as I could. What that means is that in one write transaction that's atomic, it either hits or it doesn't, we can do lots of stuff. We can do renames, we can do file writes, we can unlink directories in one go. And they're idempotent. They either applied or they didn't. We don't have to test if we already did a delete, but then someone else created it, and now are we deleting what we were asked, or are we deleting the thing that somebody else just wrote? It's idempotent. It's either there or it's not. And it's all there or it's all not. That's key for recovery, mostly. It's much easier if a server reboots, the client just spews everything that was in flight, and the server can apply it or not, depending on if it hit disk or not yet. And it doesn't have to unwind partial state.
Yes, sir.
Right, so the question is, how much do these idempotent atomic write transactions rely on the storage to notice when there's a failure. It's checksums and sequence numbers. So if a transaction weren't applied when we went to read it, we'd find badness and have to unwind and repair. The second data point, the rest are sort of featureitis. Yeah, the first one's sort of critical for system simplicity. Simplicity or complexity. The rest are just sugar we get. Client to drive checksums of file data. We can calculate checksums in memory on the client, and there's space in the disk format to write those. So calculated on write, transport all the way down, get back up, and verified again in client on read. So a lot of the path is covered by checksums. Back the slide with the sad face. We can get to data without a directory entry pointing to it. So the way a client represents a file in memory, a reference to a file, the server can find on disk without there having to be a name for that file. No silly renaming. Snapshots, Butterfest does it, we can do it too. I don't know, I mean, I assume everyone agrees that's awesome. A side effect of the way Butterfest does coherency, or correctness, or reliability, however you say it, it never writes to data that is referenced. It only writes to free space and then does a final write that now references all that stuff you just wrote. So we avoid some corruption cases. And there's a neat feature that nothing really uses, but all the on-disk Butterfest formats have sequence numbers, and sequence number is the important bit for this, transaction numbers, really. So if you have a transaction number in the past, you can walk the data in the file system and discover all the new data efficiently, right? It's O new data instead of O storage or O tree depth or anything. And that's interesting for bringing up a hot failover spare. We can sync new data to it quickly instead of having to walk the whole file system and find what's new, right? This is stuff we get from Butterfest that I think justify the cost to users of having to get their data into Butterfest. Yes, sir?
Does the last file still work if your file system is
full? Well, so Aaron's being kind of a jerk and putting out that. the observation is that these copy-on-write transactions need free space to work. I think that's what you're getting at. And yes, it's complicated. Maybe we can get into how this system makes that a little easier than doing Butterfest in the kernel on a POSIX client. But yes, we have to be very careful to avoid space loss stuff. OK, this is the fun slide. We're going to learn about the ButterFS disk format in as much as we need to understand it for the CRFS wire client. Everything in ButterFS is identified by a fixed size key and is a variable length amount of data. So to find anything in the file system, you have to construct this key to find it. 64-bit object ID, U8 type, and that type is things like it's an inode, or it's a directory, or it's file data, or it's a checksum. And the offset is context dependent on the type. So for files, that's the byte offset of the data. For directory entries, it's a hash, and we'll see this down here in the leaf. This fantastic GraphViz wizardry here is showing us discovering key value pairs in a lookup. Start the super block, you get to an indirect block, and you compare the key you're looking for with the array of keys in the indirect block, and you follow the pointer down to the next indirect block, and so on until you reach a leaf. And you know, this is B-tree 101. In the leaf, we have these key value pairs, right? We have an array of key values, and then you manage all the variable size items in the free space in the leaf. So for illustration purposes, say we want to look up our file called HW, whose contents is hello world. We construct a key that is that 300, it's a Durant type, and we know we're looking for the file name HW, so we hash it, and that becomes the offset. We traverse the B tree looking for that key we just constructed. That gives us this directory entry, and that directory entry tells us it's inode 301. We now construct a key that is inode 301, it's an inode type, and in this case, the offset's just zero. We traverse again, but we end up in the same leaf, and here it is. This is the inode for that hello world file. I'm gonna brush over some complication here, but we discover that its size is small, so we know that there's an inline file item that has the data. So we construct another key that is 301, the inode number of our hello world file, but we change the type to the file data. Again, traverse the B tree, and again, end up in this same leaf, and there's our file data packed in the B-tree leaf. So what to take away from all this rambling is that in the leaves, we have all the data addressed by these keys, and the key value pairs are packed in B-tree leaves. So in one B-tree leaf, you can have quite a lot of related data because the way we chose the keys, how we construct the keys And then the keys are sorted, obviously, because it's a B-tree, and each leaf, you get a range of the key space. The way we decided to represent the file system data in these keys, you end up sorting data into leaves that's related. Like in this case, we have the parent directory, a directory entry for a file, the file inode, and the file data all in one block on disk, because they all happen to be related. Yes, so there are keys, and all file system metadata are key value pairs sorted. Now we go to CRFS. And if you have ButterFS questions, we can maybe get to that at the end of the talk, because I can answer them. So, hello laptop, you can do it. This is the read side of metadata in CRFS. These are the structs straight out of the source. When a server wants a given piece of metadata, say in that last example, we want that hello world file again, we want to do that same operation, we construct that key, the 300 inode HW or whatever it was, we construct that key and the client asks the server in this first struct, here's the key I want, that first member is the key. It also tells it the range of keys that it can also accept. It can say, 30 keys to the left and 60 keys to the right, I also have room for. If you see those, I can take them too. And that final member, the bytes, is just how much total space it has to store the reply. That first struct is the message from the client to the server. The server sends back this reply, which is this range struct with a variable number of items after it, and the item struct is the one in the middle. An item is the key that represents that item, and then the offset in the packet, and the number of bytes in the data payload. So the server... Excuse me?
How do you determine the range?
So the question is, when the client asks the server and specifies a range it can accept, how does the client determine that? It turns out what the client is doing here is populating its cache. In its cache data structure, it knows the boundary for the key. It found a hole in its cache, because it has to ask the server for that key value. It knows how far that hole extends in the key space. It's an RB tree of pages, and we can get down to that. But
on the wire data structures?
Yeah, the question is, are these on the wire data structures? Yes.
Are they explicit padding in the real ones?
The attribute packed is edited. But yes, it's all padded. Yes, sir.
So
or packed. Yeah, the min and max are key logical key values that describe the range of keys. The bytes are the amount of memory that the server can give back. And that'll make sense. We'll see that happening later on in more slides. So in this reply, the server says, OK, here's a range of items. Here's the minimum key value and the maximum key value, the number of items, and the actual items themselves. So the server, as it happens, the server had better give the client the key it was asking for, or the client's just going to ask again. But what the server can do here is give it as much as the server decides is cheap for it to tell the client. And what it's doing in practice, the server is walking down to a leaf, finding everything that's in a leaf, because it had to be there anyway, but now it's all in memory. It can send as much of the leaf back as fits in the range that the client was asking for. So that, I think, the read and write, or the request and reply structure of metadata reading in CRFS. This is it. And I think the next slide, the next slide's cool. Here is an actual trace of it on the wire. Say you just did a makeFS, which I did before I did this, and I did a mount. That first two lines are decoding the query packet. The client's asking, I want key all ones, OFFFFF, but I have room for any items you got. I have nothing cached. From zero to all ones, go to town, but I only am going to put it in a page, so only give me 4K. It turns out it's doing this because it's trying to ask for the last inode in the file system so it can decide where to start allocating from, because the allocation right now, not so great. That's why it ends up asking for all ones. But what the server does is walk, in this case, right, we've just done a makeFS. We only really have one leaf with a root directory in it. So the server does that. It walks to it's trying to find all ones, so it's going to walk the right side of the tree, but it finds this only leaf, and this is the only data in the leaf. Right, so the server says, well, from 510 to all ones, this is all I got. Right, so now with a, 300 byte message, some odd, the client has a cache of all the data in the file system. If it were to do any lookups, it's not going to ask the server because it has a negative implicit cache. All keys within the range that the server told it are represented here. There's only four. If the client wants a key in this range that isn't in this packet, it knows it doesn't exist. It can tell the application, you tried to look up file hoop-de-doo, but it's not here, nothing, right? And that's kind of cool. Kind of contrived, but kind of cool. I guess the point here is that because we've flattened all the metadata into a key space, we can work with ranges, and that can be very powerful. And I think that, so I hope this makes sense. Do we need to dig in a little more what this actually looks like? We can do that in the next slide. So this is a read of empty file system, and it demonstrates the power of being able to, there's a question. Yes? The question is, the question is, this is confusing. There's lots of dot and dot dot entries and what the hell's going on. ButterFS has two copies of all directory entries. There's one indexed by a hash of the file name and one indexed by the inode number. So you'd expect there to be four here. There's also a magic one where you can put two directory entries in one item. If you do the math here, 26, 27, 53, that's what that is. And that's because Chris Mason likes to drive me crazy with special cases. You'll notice also that the inode number of the dot entry is one. but we actually, this is three ButterFS disk formats ago, and all the dot and dot dot entries are gone. They're now obviously implicit. So this is old stuff, but yes, good question. So this is a simple one. Here's a write. So the client, this is starting from the data that the client read in that last slide. An application did a makedir sumdir and then did a sync. So this is what the client sends to the server to commit that makedir. The four items that aren't highlighted are what was there previously. The blue and bold items are what are new to this packet. And if you look up in the header, there's a new layer here, this frag number last type. That's telling the server, this is a write transaction. There's only one fragment and I'm it. And it applies to these ranges of keys. This is the client saying, dear server, for this range of keys, 510 to all ones, these are the only items that exist. It's the four that were there before, but here's some new stuff. And I mean, I guess we can dig into this. We have the directory entry sumdir, both versions, hashed by file name. I'm pointing to my screen, which doesn't help you guys. The first one's hashed by the name sumdir, that big hex nonsense. The other item is keyed by its inode. Excuse me. Probably not. The question was, does my mouse work? And I'm guessing no. I probably could have to press a button somewhere, but apparently not. So what we're sending here are the directory entries that point to our new sum directory. And then the sum directory itself is at the very bottom. There's the inode for it. That 6i0 is the inode for the new directory, which has all the inode fields, UID, GID, permissions, nlink, all that stuff. And then its directory entries, which unfortunately in this version of the file system have dot and dot dot. But the message here, I get a toy.
Red button.
Red button. Oh, can you sort of see that, sort of?
Yep.
Awesome. I bet you can't see it in the video. So you can see my little dancing shaky hand here. This is the directory. Root inode, 5io. In that root inode, because the first object ID and all the keys are 5, these are all things in the root directory, we've added a directory entry pointing to sumdir, hashed by its file name, and a directory entry pointing to sumdir, hashed by or keyed by its inode number. 6i0 is the inode number. Then these last items are all that directory entry we just added. The inode itself, and then its dot and dot dot directory entries, which wouldn't be there in a modern ButterFS file format, disk format. A fun thing to notice here is that we don't have to choose an inode size beforehand. We have 104 byte inodes. We don't have 128, we don't have 512, we don't have to make a makefs tune time decision. We only store as much data as you need. And that's kind of cool. So in one packet on the wire, we assert all this stuff to the server. And the server goes and puts this in the leaves of the ButterFS B-tree and gets it on disk. And that last one, that's the server saying, yeah, it went okay. Info is an error number in that case, and that's the server saying it applied. So that's the right side of ButterFS. It's multi-fragment assertions of items inside key ranges. Remember that part. That's all a write is. The client and server have to agree on what the items mean, obviously. That's how you get a file system out of it. So here is it in aggregate. This is what happens when you actually do this with an untar. The first slide is the same as we saw earlier. It's an async export untar from a client, and there's the little network latency bound bleh, at the bottom. The lower graph is the untar from the CRFS client, and there's a small amount of write traffic at the beginning because we're filling up memory with write-back data, and then the VM decides that we've had quite enough of that and starts pushing out the dirty metadata pages. And it takes us 16 instead of 50 seconds, and this is wildly unoptimized. We could cut this down quite a bit still. It's sending way too much data. But the message here is that because the client is able to do a lot of this write traffic in memory as it builds up these key ranges, instead of a makedir, having to go to the server and back each time. We do make dirs in items, in memory, in ranges. When we decide they're big enough, we throw them all at the server. And that's what this stuff is. And this is disk bound. That SATA drive was doing 25 something megasecond. If you do it in memory, it goes up a whole lot, which is different than the async NFS export. If you do this on TempFS, you just lose the green bars. You still have it take 50 seconds. Yes? The question is, what happened to 4 seconds? Oh, yeah, so that's what I was sort of trying to describe earlier. I can use my new toy. This is low to begin with because that's how long it took us to fill up stuff in memory before the VM decided we had generated too much dirty data in memory. So we were just doing that all in client memory, yeah. So we're creating items in the file system in memory in the client, and we're not writing it out as fast as we had to until the VM said, oh, goddammit, you have way too much dirty memory. Start actually pushing the stuff out, and that's what this peak is. Or there's a bug, I don't know. But that's my best story. So many questions. Yes, in the back. Why does the network jump up after the disk starts writing? I think this is a reflection. I think disk traffic is depending on network traffic here. And the network traffic jump is from the VM asking the client to write more aggressively. That's what I think. Oh, and I might have gotten those bars. Yes? The question is, why is the disk traffic twice as high as the network traffic? Because for each of these writes, we're doing cow updates, and there's a lot of stuff in the leaves that isn't part of each write. You're having to walk indirect B-tree blocks for a lot of this stuff, and you're rewriting leaves and things. So even though, as it happens in this format, the client's asking to write more than it actually strictly needs to, you get that property again when you translate it into ButterFS trees in the server. So this is some B-tree overhead.
So it's an opportunity for optimization?
It is an opportunity for optimization, yes. and there's an interesting fallout of that. If you follow that observation far enough to start criticizing ButterFS and CRFS, small synchronous operations are slow. Because if you touch an inode, we don't just write the inode on disk. We have to write from the root of the B-trees all the way down, right? We have to do a bunch of allocation, a bunch of ref counting. So syncs are slow. There are more questions, all sorts of questions. Yes?
Do you want to tell them the way to make small asynchronous writes?
The question is, do I want to tell them how to make small synchronous writes fast? Sure. you have a journal. Instead of doing the full B-tree ops every time, you just write the leaves, and eventually something in the back later takes those leaves and does the full B-tree updates. That means, of course, in the streaming case where you're saturated, you're doing more I.O., so you might not always want to do it, but that's how you would make a really quick low latency op a little faster when you have bandwidth. More questions?
Do you know who owns the patents on
this? The question is, do we know if NetApp or Sun have the patents on that? Boy, am I happy that Oracle IP policy is for me to not answer that. Any other questions? Well, we have 10 more minutes. Maybe we can really go nuts with the questions. There's only a few more slides, and then we can just go to town, but really fast.
Are you covering in your slide, maybe, how do you handle collision of two characters to send directory? Because basically you're sending this.
Yeah. The question is, how do we make sure that clients don't try to assert things that conflict? And yeah, we can talk about that in a few slides. Yes, fast.
you haven't talked at all about a security model. Are you issuing that way?
I haven't talked about a security model. 3 slides in advance is entitled Security Hand-Waving. We'll get to it. Okay, so write transactions can be fast. Here's deletion. And I got yelled at in a practice talk that this is a really ridiculous situation, and I can explain why it's not as ridiculous as you might think. Here is the thing I ran on the client. It was a new file system. I mounted it. I untarred a Mercurial source tree. Then I started snooping, and then I removed it into the sink. And that's the only packet the client sent to the server. So we get deletion of all manner of stuff in a small amount of packets. Because obviously what's happening here, and my toy again. Remember a few slides ago when we did a mount, we were told from 510 to all ones, this is all that was there, the root directory. After you do an untar and then a remove -rf, it's true again that all that's there is the root directory. So what the client was able to do with the removal, you can imagine the client started with a cache that was full of keys and items and in amongst ranges of the file system. As it deleted those, those items went away, and it's able to just express the whole in the key space with the ranges, right? So as you remove more and more data, you end up with fewer items in memory, but they still are the same key space. So the client can tell the server, I did a bunch of removal now, so from 510 to all ones, this is all the data that's in the file system again. And what the server does to apply that write transaction is walk the leaves of the B tree again and find items on disk that the client said weren't there and remove them. The question is, the server never saw the mercurial source tree. In this case, it did because they did a sync, but it might not have. If we didn't have the sync here, the client could have expanded the mercurial tarball in memory and then gone to delete it again without the server ever having seen it. And that's roughly analogous to the VFS caches in EXQ3 and everything today, right? You can create and remove files fast enough without them hitting disk. So removal can be wildly optimal, but only if, yes? Five until questions? Five until questions. I'm rocking and rolling. Delete can be really optimal, but only when the stuff you're deleting is in a contiguous key space. So the server has to be careful when it gives out caches to try and give clients contiguous key spaces that stuff is cached in, so that if it were to remove them, it can start merging key spaces without there being holes. Deletes can be fast. Here's a trace of a remove-rf of a Linux source tree in NFS again. It's latency bound. I just didn't bother giving us the disk peaks again. It's the same thing. 92,000 packets, TCP packets, so that's ACTS and everything. I tried to graph the CRFS example with this software, and it crapped itself because it's a handful of packets. So I just thought I'd show you the packets. Because what the hell? We can start from the back, actually, that slide where it asserted that in the entire file system there's only a handful of items. That's this last packet in the corner. It's doing the same thing. This junk leading up to that is a transaction that was forced out halfway through. So it was plodding along, removing items, collapsing key space into pages, and then the VM said, you have a bunch of dirty stuff, write it out, please. Ah, crap, whatever. And it sent out a bunch of ranges, right? All these 1500s are write fragments being sent to the server. Then eventually, I think it's this 73 here? Yeah, that's the server saying, okay, got it. And then the client keeps going on in memory for a while and eventually says, okay, for the whole file system, all that's left is nothing. So it could have been even faster with some tuning, right? You can imagine telling the VM, don't push as hard, or telling the CRFS client that transactions can be bigger before they have to hit the disk. But again, this only happens in that case where the server gave the client keys that were contiguous. Removal can be fast. Oh, and so we should do the math here, right? This one, 12 seconds, not hitting disk. This is less than a second hitting disk. So when the server told it that this was all on disk, it wasn't kidding. It actually did that. I think that's it now for the actual stuff on the wire. That's as much as we're gonna get into. The rest is hand-wavy. First, we'll hand-wave concurrency. My wife's name is Alice, so I try really hard to abuse the crypto naming scheme as any chance I get because it drives her crazy. What we're doing here, we're demonstrating the state that the clients keep in memory in the concurrency protocol. So Alice's bar is, oh, and this is in the context of writing and reading one file. This is what Alice's state of the file is as she goes along. This is Bob's state of the file as he goes along. And this is Trent's. Trent is the trusted server. That's the state it thinks the file has as we go along. And we'll do this as quickly as I can here. So we start with nothing. Alice decides that she wants to write to this file. This is an application and a write system call in the client, right? Alice asks Trent if she can have exclusive access because she's going to be writing. Trent sees that it has no idea what file states the file in is in. So now it's exclusive. From now on, Trent thinks Alice has an exclusive state. These arrows are messages on the network. Trent tells Alice that it's now exclusive, so now she can actually perform the write system call because it's in an exclusive state in memory. The write system call can end here and it's still exclusive in memory. This is write back caching, but she still holds an exclusive lock on it, right? So we're at this point, and this is when Bob comes in and says, oh, hey, I'd like to read that file, right? So Bob asks the server, I want it in a shared state because I'm going to read. The server says, well, crap, hold on, Alice has it in exclusive, asks Alice to drop it to shared. In the case of file data, if you go from exclusive to shared, that's write back. So Alice writes the file data, Trent puts it on disk, Trent tells Alice the write transaction's done. Then Alice says, oh, okay, great, we're in shared now. Trent says, hey, fantastic, Bob, it's in shared now. Okay, great, and then he goes and actually tries to read it off disk, right? So this at the highest level is Well, it's messy CPU locking, right? We don't have modified, we have exclusive, shared, and valid. And in this example, it's just whole file caching state. We actually assert caching state for ranges of keys, like we did with metadata, if that makes sense. And I can't go into too much detail because it's not implemented, but boy, is it going to work. There are some observations here, right? We have this ridiculous stuff where we bounce back and forth performing operations and then, right? So the server told him the write was done and then he got the shared grant here, but at this point when the write actually finished, we could have sent the shared message back to Bob because it's now on disk, and if Bob issued a read here, we'd be done with it, right? And similarly, we did the shared request and then shared grant and then issued the file read. We could have just issued the file read and that would have been implicit shared request message, but I didn't want to overload that stuff. This is separating the actual ops to the server for disk and the cache state messages. So I hope that makes some sense. And if you want to learn a little more about this, this is the VAX-DLM protocol intersecting with MESI. And there's 1,000 questions, but there's only one more slide. And because we're supposed to be in questions now. There's 2 more slides. Security hand waving. Right now it's all raw UIDs and GIDs in memory and on the wire and is only TCP. Obviously we'll use SSL, TLS, whatever. The fun part here is that it's trusted clients today. If you want untrusted clients, we're doing write back caching. So in the client, an application does a write, and the application's told it's done, and we now have that write cached in memory. The client sends it to the server, and the server's supposed to just apply it, but the server needs to have the identity of the writer to decide if that write should be allowed. So we need identity and capability metadata in the transactions and on disk, so that when these cached metadata ops come to the server, it can audit what the application should or should not have been allowed to do. And what that means is that if there's a buggy or malicious client, the apps have already succeeded. All the server can do is break the connection and tell a bad client EIO, you're hosed. But that should be only if the thing generating the cached write transactions in the client was bad. And we have an opportunity to put crypto on disk so clients can hide data from CRFSD. This is not my initial focus because I'm going to be controversial and say that this is just applying recipes we already really know how to work once we have all these other tools that we focused on first. I'm glad that a lot of the skeptical are giggling, but I think if we get the right ninjas on this, I'm not wearing my crypto ninja hat right now, but I think if that was someone else's priority, they could get it done. We have the capabilities, I think. Okay, so you're all fantastically excited to download this stuff. Rock and roll, you want to try it? There's one more slide because I don't have my preview, so we'll just do this real quick. There's a ton of stuff left to do. And that's an opportunity to contribute, right? You can do user space stuff in CRFSD. You can do kernel stuff in the client. You can do disk file system stuff in the server, talking to ButterFS. There's all sorts of opportunity here. You can do an OSX or BSD port, right? I'd love it. You can take a bullet and go work with the ITF, right? That's fine. seriously, because I think if this is just another Linux toy, we lose. We want EMC and NetApp to want to ship this stuff too. Okay, so now I'll go into my spiel that I thought this slide was going to be. You're all excited and you want to download it, and you can't. Ah, ha, ha. Joke's on you. Despite our best efforts, we still haven't gotten the okay to release the source. That's where it'll be, and that's a teaser. It's not a huge amount of code because we're just pushing these key range things, right? Once we get that mechanism going, we don't have to have a lot of special case for disk structure. So now we have like 3 or 4 minutes for questions. Yes? In the coherency protocol, what do you do when the server crashes? You wait for clients to reestablish and replay the state. And if they don't, that state's gone. Yes, question? In the coherency protocol, what happens when a client does a close? It stays in that state. This is what Lustre and OCFS2 do today. It means that if, you know, so you've done a write and a close, you hold all the cache state still that let you do that write and close. You can do an open write again without doing more coherency traffic. And that stuff at least is well implemented. Another question?
Yeah, are you doing access control decisions on the server client or both?
The question is, are we doing access control decisions on the server client or both? What that security slide was trying to say is that we're making those decisions on the client today, and we don't have the metadata for the server to verify that those decisions were correct. We trust the client to say that whatever writes were done properly. The server says, okay, put them on disk. which clearly is unacceptable. But I might have glossed over one of the slides. The server should be walking the transactions to verify that the items it's getting aren't nonsense. That code's not done, but it will be there, I think. More questions we have. We want to be walking out of here in 5 minutes, so. Yes?
Since this is a stateful system, do you have any expectations of scale? I mean, how impactful is stateful mining?
So this is stateful. What are our predictions of how this will scale? It depends on what you're doing. If there's no, it depends on a million things, but contention is when scalability starts to be bad. If you have a bunch of clients doing untars that are unrelated to each other, they fly. If you get someone in reading and writing the same byte in a file, we're network and disk bound, but it's sharing that creates the scalability problems amongst all the clients. We only have one server, so your aggregate throughput is what you can get through the net and disk on that box. But, maybe I should say that's violently on purpose. I worked on Lustre and OCFS2. Any other questions? The question is this, no distributed, no parallel, is that a final judgment or is it a focus decision? I think I'll say the latter. We don't want to focus on that initially, but once we have all this infrastructure in place working with key ranges, currency protocol, I think there are enough examples out there how to start to scale that, but it gets very complicated because you have write transitions spanning failure domains and you have to make allocation bouncing decisions on the clients. Yeah, if we come to a point where this first pass is stable and we want to branch out, it's possible, I think. It might become CDFS, right, instead of CRFS or something. But, yes, more questions?
When you've got shared disk storage, this protocol looks like it'd be able to have bypass without sending the actual data back.
The question is, it looks like this protocol could have, if you had shared storage between servers and clients, this protocol might allow you to do bypass or what some people call parallel access from the clients directly to disk. I'll have forks in my eyes if they do that. ButterFS makes it really, really hard to see where things are going to be on disk over time because it's copy and write trees. So like the cluster stuff, that's a direction you could go in if you wanted to spend a ton of complexity for a few users. It's not what I want to be doing, but I mean, people may want to. And there's all sorts of stuff, right? RDMA, on and on. Not an initial focus, I think. More questions? Yes. Sorry, I can't hear you. The question is file mapping, and those two words is a question I don't understand. mmapped files, is that what we're talking about? Okay, yes. The question is mmap coherency. Lustre and OCFS2 implement this today. What it means is that when you have a page in the page cache for file data, it has to hold a cache coherency state. So when you get an mmap fault, you try and hold that part of the file in shared, and you'll just block until you get it. Then you satisfy the fault. If the server revokes your shared access, you invalidate that mapping in page. So this is implemented today. I mean, you can go look at the code in OCFS2. And that's sort of the model for all these cache coherency protocols. To populate the cache, you have to request and hold a state. When you're told to revoke it, you have to invalidate that state. And you see this, it calls all the page cache invalidation functions for file data. On the metadata side, it's going, blowing away dentries and inode caches and all that stuff. And you just have to mush those bits together. Are there more questions? I think we still have five. Yeah, still 5 minutes, so we can go on more. I think. Yeah, okay, yeah. We're good? No more questions? Yeah, so watch this URL. Hopefully, weeks, months, not decades, it'll be available. Yeah, and send mail to Oracle. Good, I'm giving pressure. So thank you for coming. I hope.